Welcome to the Disruptive Tech Podcast. This is our third episode. I'm joined here again by Scott McDonald and Mike Rook, my conspirators in crime here, inflicting this course upon the world. Disruptive Tech, that course, of course, is Disruptive Technologies for Teaching and Learning here at Penn State.
That course, of course.
Yes, a course, of course. What can you do with a course? No, that's good. So how are you guys doing?
Great.
Awesome.
Good, good. We're here on a Friday.
Friday morning.
Somewhat morning, late morning. It's a good time.
It is. Ideal time of day to podcast.
And I feel like my levels are all in alignment here. It's good. Although I did mean to like blast some Motorhead, Ace of Spades or something before we recorded to get our energy level up, and I forgot to do that. So we're just going to have to...
I like Firestarter for that.
Do you know Firestarter? I don't think I know that one. Is that like classic or is that modern day?
No, that's like late 80s, early 90s. Prodigy, an English band.
I know that one. Yeah. Yes, that works too.
It's good. It's good pregame music.
Yeah.
You don't have a suggestion? Barry Manilow.
Yeah. What do you listen to pump your?
I'm just messing.
Yeah. What pumps you up before recording a big podcast like this?
Oh, I could probably.
Maybe do some headstands.
GNR.
GNR. Interesting choice. I would not have pegged that, but there you go.
Kicking it old school. Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, when I was playing soccer, we used to listen to some Rage and then Michael Jackson, like back to back.
Wow, that could.
So what was the what? What was the? Was there like a strategy to mixing those two that way, or?
I don't know. It was "Beat It" by Michael J. and I forget the Rage song, but it worked.
It was like
all that matters.
They, you know, some sonic alchemist mixed just the perfect stuff together to create
I'll make
that.
Sure it's clear that this was not me in my tape. It was someone on my team's mixtape.
Okay,
and that was just the thing.
Well, I think we should start the next podcast with each of us playing a snippet from one or two songs that get us pumped up.
Perfect. Intellectual property be damned.
Yeah, that's right.
It's fair use if we keep it to 0 seconds, I think, is actually the rule. But
yeah, well,
we always
security through obscurity. Nobody listens to this podcast anyway, so the fact that we're playing copyrighted music on it won't make any difference at all. Or we just won't play it. We'll just play it into our own headphones and then sing it into the microphone so other people can enjoy our rendition of Ace of Spades.
Or lip sync.
You know,
lip sync. That would be nice.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something about Ace of Spades? No.
Well, I was thinking, I was thinking there. Yeah, never mind.
Okay.
For a second, I got confused and thought, even though I had originally brought up Ace of Spades, when you had said it, I had thought Ace of Base.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing.
That's a whole different thing. But again, maybe like the whole MJ Rage, you could mix up Ace of Base and Ace of Spades. It's the perfect mashup. It's the Ace of mashup.
And then you could play "All About the Bass" by Meghan Trainor, and it would be just awesomeness all the way down.
Yeah.
Okay.
All appeal to all demographics.
That's right. Build our audience.
That's right.
So what are we actually here to do, Brad?
So, I'm going to ask Scott. I think you need to move a little bit further back.
Okay.
There's
sorry
a gain on that mic. I'm not much of an audio
it's
engineer.
It's a little hot.
But it's distorting out a little bit, I think.
We don't want that.
I think. I'm actually monitoring here today, so it's kind of destroying my mind a little bit, but it's good.
We do not want that.
We want a quality audio product at the end of this.
We do.
Even though we are recording here from inside the engine room of the Starship Enterprise, there's many fans and other things going, so it's perfect. Perfect. Perfect place to record
ideal
a podcast. So we do have at least one listener, we know, which is good.
Thank you, Cole.
Yes, thank you, Cole, for your comments and for your very thoughtful comments. Let me pull that up here. The original, Cole did have a lot to say on both our episodes, but in the first one I thought maybe I can read some of that and we can talk about that a little bit. I mean, Cole says, just a few thoughts as I listen to you guys. First, I love this reflective practice. It is such a smart thing to do. I have to say, back in the day, Scott and I would have these crazy conversations after class as we walked to the parking garage, but we never grabbed them like this. I encourage you to keep this up.
Check.
Check. Thank you, Cole.
Yeah.
We're going to keep, we're in it for the long haul.
Yeah. At least 15 episodes.
It's a marathon. We'll see. I think we'll make it to the end, though. He does, then Cole then talks about, a couple thoughts from the administrator, because, of course, Cole is the chief information officer at Stony Brook University. And he talks about how they do give them HBO Go for free and how that is part of the, that's just part of the student experience there. And, and talks about, comparing HBO Go and the learning experience, doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense, which, I could kind of agree with that. I mean, I think the point we were making, because I don't think there's any reason to think, that a university shouldn't provide, a residential experience, right? Like, that's just, access to just these cable programmings. That's just part of what you expect if you're going to be mm-hmm. living on campus. So
yeah.
I can't really, I don't think we in any way meant to, like, besmirch the integrity of Stony Brook or any place else that might provide HBO Go. But it is a question of, is the learning, again, the conceptualization of learning. And it goes into the question of the business so a lot of these business model discussions, which we started off the course with, is kind of part of the context here, since all this talk of the disruption. And there was just an article I saw the other day in the Philadelphia Inquirer from the, I believe it was the president of Delaware University, or University of Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what is down in Delaware these days. But, again, talking about the disruption and the technology coming to change everything. But... So, and Cole does go on to talk about the business models, which is to say, and I'll skip to the end here, but Cole saying, I would argue that none of the business models have anything to do with what we should be doing in our classrooms, and I find it fascinating that faculty would feel that pressure. Is that a real pressure, or is that something that is invented by the crush of the edtech pop culture reporting of our, quote, demise, end quote?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think about with that, too, is it, speaking as a faculty member, it feels more like the administrators are the one feeling that pressure. But I'm not an administrator, so maybe Cole can speak to that. But this sense that administrators are feeling like we have to find revenue streams for our university, like we have to make our quote-unquote business profitable. I don't think individual faculty members feel that. I think we tend to worry about much more provincial stuff, like what's going on in our department. Are our numbers down? But not so much in the sense of, like, we need to generate revenue, but just in terms of, that's worrisome. If we have fewer students in our program, then what's going on there? Is that us? Is it a social thing? Is it something else going on that we're not aware of? So I'd be interested to hear what Cole thinks about that from an administrator's point of view. And then I said this before we started, so Brad kept his powder dry, but I started talking before we went on the air. And just saying that I think this question of business models and whether higher ed is a business or not, I mean, I'm still struggling with it, but my gut remains that it's not a business in the traditional sense of what we talk about, like when Clayton Christensen talks about a business in a market, right? So we don't have the same sort of pressures, or there we have pressures, but we have different kinds of pressures, and we are a different kind of institution. And because of that, I think we have to be thoughtful about the differences and not paint in a broad brush way across, businesses and higher ed, even though both require money coming in and money going out. Even just nonprofits versus profit institutions, there's obviously a difference there. But I think even beyond that, higher ed institutions are sort of a slightly unique thing in the world. So I don't. So I am uncomfortable with thinking about it in terms of a market. But that may be just me being uncomfortable with it. Maybe right. It's truer than I'd like to think.
Well, I mean, there's ultimately a reality, right? Like you said, there's a reality of costs coming in and expenses going out. That just has to be addressed, and that has to match at the end of the day. And higher ed, the prices of higher ed have skyrocketed without a doubt, and that is a societal problem here in the United States and as well as across the world, I believe. Mm-hmm. But and I think looking at for solutions to that, a lot of administrators, pundits, politicians, everyone is looking to the business world. Okay, we need to think of like business. How do businesses become profitable? How do they streamline? How do they cut costs? And I think there could be a fundamental misunderstanding of what it is higher ed does. And when they're not thinking about deeply about what learning is, what the role of higher ed is, and just simply see it more like, again, the knee-jerk reaction is to look at it as some kind of consumption exercise, right? Or some kind of content production, like, oh, you go, you consume this content, now you know things, you can move on. That's where this becomes dangerous, or there's a disconnect.
Well, it's a product orientation, right? I mean, whether we call it content or not, it's this idea that we sell a product, or even that we sell a service, which is probably closer to the truth, but still makes me uncomfortable. But I think we generally do that. That is usually the way that higher ed gets talked about, is this idea of like, oh, well, we have a product, right? Our product is a 4-year degree and a piece of paper or whatever it is. So I think, this question of what do we actually, if we are a business, what do we sell? And Cole sort of gets to that, like in his question about, right before the paragraph you read, he talks about, the question I have is, where does the higher ed as an experience diverge from higher ed as a learning experience? I think that's a great question. And there's mm-hmm. been some talk of that or critique of that over time. But Beer and Circuses comes to mind, which is sort of a critique of higher ed about how it's really about distracting students with big-time sports programs and the ability to drink. Which distracts them from the fact that the quality of their education has sort of been going down and down and down. Now, I don't know that I believe that, but that there's a book about that, and so I think there is an interesting question about, what role does HBO Go play, free HBO Go play in that constellation of creating an experience versus a learning experience, and right. Which one are we trying to sell the students?
Yeah, well, but also without a doubt, there's. I think it might be hard to say where the learning, to say, it's just hard to say, oh, here's an experience, and that bad experience was not a learning experience, right, on some level. That's just really hard to say. But I think without a doubt there is, outside of what happens in the formal instruction and formal coursework and formal assessment and everything else, there's a whole constellation of experiences that are valuable learning experiences that happen on a campus. And even, access to something like HBO Go, like I said before, and I mean it, right? Like, yes, like I think it makes perfect sense to offer that. Mm-hmm. That does that in no way, I think takes away from, the integrity of an institution or anything like that. It's just one of the basic creature comforts that I think is expected in the year 2015. Mm-hmm. I kind of think of this similar to some of the discussion I've been reading online regarding Apple. It's always been ongoing, right? So Apple, again, they are a business, and they sell this product, but always there's all these, again, pundits saying, Apple needs to do this. Apple products are too expensive, or they're doomed because of this. Oh, they just had the biggest quarter in history of any company. Well, here's why it's all bad, because...
There's nowhere to go but down from there.
Yeah, exactly. And, they just did it because now they're... chasing someone else's idea and not doing their own. But, again, there's this fundamental, I think, misunderstanding of what Apple does and what Apple provides. And it doesn't fall into this very basic kind of business logic, right? It falls outside of maybe, it's an outlier to the Clayton Christensen's theory in some ways, because he's always talking about more modularity, open systems are better, mm-hmm. The cheaper thing is going to win out, whereas Apple is... closed, It's all one integrated experience, yeah. And it's very expensive. But again, it's a high. But because of that, right, they leverage that appropriately and have, sure. You know, create this incredibly designed experience that's very powerful. And they're now becoming incredibly profitable because of that. So I wonder if higher ed could. There's a room there, right, for higher ed to be similar to that, right? Like this is. What they're offering is just simply misunderstood by when if you try to compare it to General Motors or Dell PCs or something like that. But then also part of it is the fact that we're selling this kind of integrated experience. It's not this kind of modular like, oh, I'm going to take my tests here and I'm going to go to the football games from the football company and I'm going to get my resonance. You know, it is this tightly coupled experience kind of designed from the ground up from beginning to end, or at least maybe it should be, right? And yeah, as we move away from that, right, so maybe in some ways, right, if we're going to be doom and gloom, we could say we're offering the worst of both worlds in the sense that it is this kind of monolithic entity experience and it's also bad,
right?
So how could we take that and make that how do we make that better and take the strengths of the fact that that's how it's currently organized and probably the better way to be organized.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to throw in kind of like a wrench to this discussion as we're going. So you were talking about tuition increases and just the fact that how expensive a college tuition and a college experience is nowadays and the fact that you come out with all kinds of loans. And if we're talking about an integrated experience where, in addition to learning as a main, if you want to call it outcome, but that's a sad word sometimes, the addition to learning is, I don't know, a good football program or getting to get Bon Jovi into our performing arts center, you know, like some
Rage Against the Machine, Michael Jackson, Bon Jovi.
That's right.
There you go.
Yeah. There's kind of a, if you think about the way MOOCs or online or kind of this competency-based program that we've been kind of throwing out there as what people are calling a disruptor, I just wanted to add one other piece to that and not necessarily argue for or against them, but just say that thinking about the privilege that comes with being able to afford a college of education or being able to pay those loans back.
Yeah.
Or not have to pay those loans because your parents can pay for you to go to school and so you don't accrue loans.
That's why I think that the discussion of online is getting such a following behind it because people are starting to say, well, let's decouple learning from everything else. And let's just say, okay, the people that don't have privilege, let's just get them the learning so that way they can get a job.
Yeah.
But that also, there's an assumption there that online is cheaper, which, is it cheaper? Or, you know, maybe it can be if you do, like, okay, you can start having faculty-student ratios of, like, 1 to 5,000 or something like that. But then, you know, again, what happens to this whole experience?
Yeah, and that, well, and then you get this weird situation, and I'm not remembering the name of the company that was doing this, but it was an online education company, and they were helping their students get Stafford and federal loans or grants so that they could get them to pay tuition, but then most of them were dropping out or not being able to complete this work. Right. So, yeah. And we don't have to throw them under the bus, but this idea of what happens when a higher ed institution actually gets run like a business. I mean, we don't have to look far to find examples of that. So how does that change this curated relationship that Brad's trying to talk about building within higher ed where, like, it's all part of the experience. It's like Disneyland, right? So you go and you have your little wristband and you get your meals and all your experiences are curated and everything feels, you know, self-contained. I think that's a really interesting idea for higher ed. Like, what would that look like if we curated everything and it was sort of all the Penn State experience, you know? But I do think this question of cost is in the mix, and how do we deal with it, and how do we? I mean, going back to the Apple thing, one of the things that I was struck by is Apple has a history of sort of being willing to cannibalize its own markets or abandon products, essentially. I mean, I don't know if they think about it this way, but certainly it's been talked about this way. So I guess I wonder what would be the thing that higher ed's willing to abandon. Like, what are we willing to cannibalize? Like, yeah, and right now the answer seems to be we're increasingly willing to cannibalize resident instruction for online instruction. And with whether it's MOOCs or whether it's traditional online instruction, and people are bragging about the number of students now who are resident students at Penn State who take at least one of their courses online. And maybe that's bragworthy or maybe it's not, but there's this question of, are we cannibalizing one part of our business to push another part of it forward? And if so, what are the long-term consequences for that? Because it could be powerful. You know, you could get sort of the iPad version of what happened with Apple, iPhone, iPad version, or you could have disaster. You could have like the music industry, right? Where they're gone. You know, essentially their big section of that market is now gone. So I do think it's a question of where we're going to end up.
So, well, just close out this part. You know, we'll say, again, thanks, Cole, for the comments. We're happy to know we have at least one listener out there willing to comment. So we salute you.
We salute you. We're all standing up and saluting right now, actually.
That's
right. So class last Tuesday was interesting, as always. We talked about the looking at technology to become this social glue, the kind of community building. And, you know, we expected maybe to have, one to surface to the top, but it turned out people kind of splintered into factions. And now we're investigating several different technologies, at least for the time being.
The interesting thing, I think, one of the interesting things that I want to point to is when we produced our initial list, we had a bunch of things on there that I think surprised all of us, the biggest one being Yik Yak. So there were three folks who put Yik Yak out on the table as a possibility of something to be our social glue. And, I felt immediately like we needed to post the podcast from Reply All where they talk about what happened at Colgate and mm-hmm. with Yik Yak. But just this, you know, it's really interesting when you sort of throw it open to seeing who wants to use what to do their communication.
Yeah, so the what the students are currently looking at, again, kind of surprising. So first is Reddit.
Very big surprise.
Sure. Which is, Twitter, which perhaps is not such a big surprise.
No.
I guess I'm old school now because I'm like, yeah, Twitter, of course, that's what you use.
Well, and interestingly, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but that was already happening. There were already people using that as social glue in the class. We were just less aware of it because we hadn't mandated it this time.
Yeah, so we set up probably a significant portion of that course to get in a group of Reddit, Twitter, and the third one was then Google Community, mm-hmm. and establish a workflow to get new members into whatever community. So set up an admin that will help to invite people. And we went through that process, and then reflecting, looking back at the site to see, you know, getting into these communities, I was struck by Google Community was, you know, fairly new. Reddit, only one person it seemed like in class was a regular member, but then Twitter, people were already using the hashtag that we thought we would introduce to everyone, but it had been happening mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. not only a week, but couple weeks.
Yeah, since class began. I mean, yeah. I think at least Priscilla and maybe Audrey, I don't know, were tweeting from the first day of class. So, yeah, I think that's interesting.
And I was surprised that when I was helping to lead that session on Tuesday, a couple people were tweeting what I was saying. So that was also interesting to look back after that.
Yeah, little, what you actually said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Because it was basically discussing what were the purpose of introducing these technologies into our class, because there are a lot of people that were saying, well, why do we need one more technology to get into, which is a common reaction that you have from students. But Zach had just very, very shortly kind of summarized what I said. Continued conversations, peripheral participation, and extending the walls are the main points of adding mm-hmm. the back channel.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see where the Reddit goes, if anywhere. So, Reddit has always fascinated me in the sense that in some ways it's, I kind of think of it as it's a very internet native platform.
Yeah.
You know, it's able to handle massive amount of users all kind of in dialogue with each other, and it's able to do that in a way where it makes sense. Versus, you know, you couldn't necessarily take, let's say, a traditional like discussion board that you might find in a course, and be like, okay, now we're going to add 30,000 people or 6 million people to that. Like, it wouldn't necessarily work. But Reddit kind of scales that way, and then, again, there's tons of conventions and everything else that go along with that to enable that, as well as this kind of line between you can be anonymous or not. Or have an identity that's separate from your real identity, or not, and ways people play with that. So it's really interesting. The other thing I'll kind of put in that category is 4chan, which is, you know, has been gotten a lot of attention lately, obviously for various nefarious activities. And yes, without a doubt, it is a wretched hive of scum and villainy in a lot of ways.
Nicely played.
Yes, but again, everything there being completely anonymous. And it, in my mind, that kind of harkens back to the original. Well, original is a strange word. For me, the original internet. So, you know, I started using the internet in the mid-90s, probably like 93, 92, something like that. This was even like before web, so I was like on there.
Pre-Netscape.
Yeah, yeah. I was. Yeah. It was all just the, you know, terminal screen type stuff going on. Like that was my internet experience for several years. And I remember when people were started talking about the browser and stuff, and I was like, "What is this? Who would ever what?"
I like bulletin boards.
Yeah, let me go back to my like text on the screen where I can type in commands and like be efficient and get things done and look at what's happening. But again, there was this sense of like, oh, you're in this world, right? The real world, let's call it, going around doing your thing. But then you get on to this computer and it's unlimited possibility in the sense of who you are, you know? And just the fact that you were on there was enough to, like, if you knew someone in real life that was on there, that was enough just to create a bond, right? Like, now it's not like, oh, you have a Facebook account, too? That's so cool. Let's, like, talk about Facebook, right? Like, you can't, you couldn't do that. But at the same time, while you're on there, like, you could, and again, it's really powerful, I think, for, again, at my time, you know, I was in high school at that time, like, when you're trying to play with identity and all this stuff, like, it's an incredibly powerful tool to do that, which is why we still see teens today, like, going online and harkening back to that, how teens see social media, right? And this whole idea that you can go to a place like Tumblr and just, like, you know, it's not connected to your real life at all, and you can do whatever. I think that's still it's an interesting component of the internet experience, and I feel like it's one that, in a lot of ways, with a combination, I guess, perhaps of our age being professional, and then also just with, you know, it just having mass adoption, right, that there was a sort of a magic that was lost.
Yeah, and, I mean, one of the other things I think about with all that related to how sort of the technologies get used, and thinking about the three that we're using, is this like, it seems to me that there's been this move in social media towards ephemerality, right? Like, my daughters don't, like, I have all my email from the last 20 years, like, stored in various places, but certainly within my Gmail, I've got like the last 5, 6, 7 years that it's all searchable, access all of it. But my daughters use, you know, text and Snapchat and, you know, things that disappear, and they don't have any sort of record of their social interactions with these other people. So this idea that you were talking about, like, oh, you're on Facebook? I'm on Facebook too. Let's talk. You know, like, they don't even have, they can't even look back to see any of their history. And I find that really fascinating. Like, and maybe that's naive. I mean, in the olden days, you know, first you had letters, and those obviously you kept forever. Most people didn't even put them in a shoebox in your basement or something. But then you had the telephone. So, like, when I was a kid, like, that was the main mode of communication, you know, the telephone that was attached to the wall. And there's no record of that either, right? So that mode of communication, and certainly most, like, oral communication is ephemeral, you know, unless it's on a podcast.
Right.
So this question of like ephemerality and some of our like the Twitter group, that's all pretty ephemeral. I mean, you can find it and it's accessible, but it's not searchable and accessible in the same way. But Reddit is, from what I gather, that's a little more of a permanent repository, as is Google Community. So those are like searchable, accessible.
Right. What Reddit does is give you the kind of a thin veil of pseudo-anonymity where, you know, you can create a user ID, make it whatever, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, like, it's not going to show up when you're trying to apply for a job and people are searching your name and things like that. And I think about that move to ephemerality now. Like, what, you know, all last decade, what did the adults say to children, like, at every point? Yeah. It's like, oh, be careful what you put out there. Because it'll be out there
forever.
It'll be out there forever. Think about what you do before you post that photo, right? So in some ways, you know, all the people being told that, they're now in their 20s and starting these companies where it's like, all right, here's the thing where it's not there forever. So I can actually, like, share the picture of someone barfing on the street last night with my friends because it's really funny and I want to do that.
But I don't have to worry about being linked with it forever and being in my Facebook account.
I was actually looking at an article where this woman from Gizmodo, have you guys seen this article where she talks about creepy ways to just creep people out on Facebook?
No.
Where you go back to, like, when someone started using Facebook, they have a birth date, right? And so you can go back, and Facebook has that as an event. And so then this person would then go in and say, wish I had been there, right, for being born, or like tag herself in a couple's wedding photo,
nice,
something like that. And so it's right, Facebook keeps a record of pretty much everything that you're doing. And so I think part of that conversation of the adults were telling teens or preteens, you know, be careful with what you put out there. I think that was, for the most part, over the last like 3-4 years, has been geared towards Facebook. But now that Facebook is like
an old technology,
it's now it's a different set of rules and protocols.
Right. So do we have to update our conversation with teens now?
Maybe.
Yeah. No, you don't have to worry about because I do remember going to, like, at conferences, that was a common trope. Like, somebody would stand up and say, kids today don't understand the digital footprint that they're leaving and the long history that they're going to have that reaches back decades. And I'm taking pictures of my kid now and I'm posting them on the internet and my kid has no control over that. And that's going to live on forever with his name tagged to it. And then now we have kids who are like, you know, they're on Snapchat and it's gone.
So now it's more kind of like a use protection type conversation. Make sure you post your pictures on Snapchat.
Right.
But remember that someone on the other end can always take a screenshot.
No, they can't, can they? Or is that a new thing? I thought for a while that was locked out. No, I thought
it was... Maybe they fixed that somehow.
I don't know.
I think at first that was a...
A problem.
Of a problem.
Yeah.
I didn't know if there was a... I didn't think there was a technological solution to that in iOS. But maybe there is now. Maybe they worked something out.
Yeah.
I did notice... so this is a weird aside, but... I did install Yik Yak. I'm kind of late to the Yik Yak game, but after talking about it in class, actually while we were talking about it in class, I installed it. And later that evening, I was looking through the Yaks, and I did find something I wanted to save. So I tried to take a screenshot. So I took a screenshot of it, and I assumed it worked. I didn't actually check my photo roll, but it did come up with a message that was like, "Yo, bro. I know that you try to take a screenshot. Just so you know, we have all kinds of great sharing stuff in here." So again, I just didn't like saying like you're not allowed as much. It was like, oh, there's actual ways to do this better than taking screenshots, which is the new way to do things, if you haven't noticed.
Oh,
like,
of course, yeah. Like taking pictures of stuff.
Yeah, like, well, of screenshots on your phone. Like, I'm reading an article. Rather than like copy the text, make it a block quote in a blog post and say, oh, here's what so-and-so and link back. You just like take a screenshot of what you're reading, and you can even use the selection tool to select the specific sentence you're trying to get, and then just like tweet out that picture. Like, look what this person said. Here it is. And, you know, in some ways, like, you know, I think people that are more I could just see how, like, traditional internet users, like, that might give them hives. But really, like, well, one, it's solving a fundamental problem, which it's not as easy to share these things on mobile devices. And also, it works.
But it's not searchable.
I mean, if you're blind of hearing sight impaired, like, yeah, it's a major problem. But
well, and it's not searchable, and it's not – I mean, there are real problems with it. Mm-hmm. But you know, the thing that made me think about this, especially sitting in the room with the room in the room with the room in the room with the guy that was mostly responsible for the platform, the blogging platform here, is like one of the big things that came out of that at Penn State was this idea that your higher education experience wouldn't be ephemeral because you'd have this intellectual record of your portfolio. Mm-hmm. And now you think like, oh, okay, so that worked for that generation who wanted to be out there, who, like, social media was a way for them to build an identity or a mm-hmm. brand or whatever it was. But now it's like, oh, well, if it's all ephemeral, the flip side of that is you don't have any record of this. So you graduate from college and, you know, all your stuff is gone,
right.
You know, because you use these ephemeral modes of communication and record keeping. So I think that's the – so what does that mean for that higher ed thing, right? Like, what's your – you know, because I do remember there were these grand conversations about how we would be able to link classes across multiple years and you'd be able to draw in your learning from this mm-hmm. course into that course because you'd have this whole historical intellectual product of your blog. And now it's like, it's all on Twitter and it's gone. You know, I can't even find it.
Like, well, I think the trick with all that is, I mean, I think there's a place for, you know, building your you know, online presence, your personal brand, if you want to call it that, whatever it is, right? Here's my intellectual output. There's a place for ephemeral media. There's a place for things that are kind of in between, which is Twitter, which is very much a, oh, well, let me try to make connections, you know, for lack of a better word, professionally, right? And there's a place for all that. And I think the trick is helping students do all that with intention, right? Versus just like throwing stuff out there in willy-nilly in different ways and thinking about like, why would I post this to Facebook or Snapchat or a university blogging system or my Tumblr, right? Like, how do all those things work together to both help with my learning, to both enable my learning as well as to enable my you know, my learning and my professional life, you know, after I move on from school. So, yeah. All right.
Well, we're probably getting close to wrapping up, right?
Yeah, we are. I mean, do you want to mention quick the
I do. That's
some new stuff has come to light.
Well, I think it's more that I had a podcast related experience that has sharpened my interest in something we'd already planned. So, so yesterday I was listening to the podcast Startup, and their newest episode about Fake It Till You Make It was about them deciding about an app. And as part of that, they brought in Google Ventures to come and do a design sprint with them. And we, as a team for Disruptive Tech, had been talking about not explicitly a design sprint, but some human-centered design activity for our class that would start in the next cycle. So I guess this serves as a warning for the students that beware, it's coming, and we're going to have you listen to this podcast because it was really smart and interesting. And I don't think we'll get Google Ventures to pop into our class
to do
a design sprint. But you never know. Because they could be the number – so first we have Cole, and our number two listener could be somebody at Google Ventures who's like – that is something I am interested in flying across the country to help out with. And if so, my email is smcdonald@psu.edu, and we would be happy to hear from you and have you come join our class.
I mean, but they started a Google community.
That's true. They could just join that and then fly out after and help us with the design sprint. But anyway, we will be doing human-centered design next cycle. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like or how designing an app is related to designing a service like higher ed or some part of higher ed, but it's a grand experiment, and the experiment continues.
And I wanted to mention that if you are interested in joining our communities, on Reddit, it's PSU Disruptive Tech, no spaces. On Google Community, it's Disruptive Technologies, so spaces in between those two words, space hashtag CI597. And on Twitter, all you have to do is search for CI597, and you'll be able to follow along with the community.
Mm. I wonder if that brings in, because CI597 is a generic experimental course number, so I wonder if anybody else is using that hashtag in CNI. I don't know. We'll inquiring minds want to know, so we'll check that out and report back next episode.
Yes. So we talked about how we didn't have our sign-off, although I think you may have just inadvertently created it, Scott.
Really?
Yeah.
What did I say?
The experiment continues.
Ah, boom. I like there that. It is. The experiment continues.
All right.
Nice.
The experiment continues.
Experiment continues.
Until next time.